You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 2nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Van Taylor on his film Advise and Dissent, I should say, on those 7-8 months in which Scalito and John Roberts and nearly Harriet Myers made it to the Supreme Court back under the Bush administration. The film came out 2 years ago, just as relevant today. Justice relevant today? And will be more relevant in the coming months as well. Also on the program today, ExxonMobil, we'll all adapt to 105 degree weather. Joe Paterno, he's dead now. I don't want to speak poorly of the dead, but didn't seem to have his priorities straight. This LIBOR Barclays scandal, massive, and generating a lot of outrage in Britain. Soon, maybe here, probably not. Mitt Romney on education and the equal opportunity for the rich only. New reports on what we may expect in the lame duck. And a Mississippi judge upholds an anti-abortion law for the time being. We will get to all of that. First up, we'll get to this, but we'll get to this story in just a moment. We're going to go and go get our guest. But the implications of the Affordable Care Act ruling, we're already starting to see. Rick Scott has said that his state will not accept the expansion of Medicaid. Understand, and we'll talk about this later in the program, but understand that when it comes to Medicaid, Medicaid ends up covering a lot of elderly people in nursing homes. Because what happens is, they use up their savings, they use up their Medicare to the point where they fall below the poverty line, which allows them to be eligible for Medicare in nursing homes. This, of course, would have raised that floor to 133%. We'll talk more about it as the show continues. And remember, you know, Rick Scott, he loves generally that Medicare money. But I guess not so much the flow to the actual people eligible for Medicare. We'll remind you of that when we return. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Van Taylor.
Yeah.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program David Van Taylor, the producer and director, yes, of Advise and Dissent. Of course, also the maker of With God on Our Side and A Perfect Candidate. Welcome to the program, David.
Great to be here.
Well, let me pull up your sound a little bit. Now, I got to tell you, someone just recommended to me With God on Our Side a couple of weeks ago. I have not seen that. I saw A Perfect Candidate, and of course, I've seen Advise and Dissent. A Perfect Candidate, I got to tell people, it was the story of I've just lost his name. When Oliver North ran for senator in Virginia, and I got to say that film was. Was where I think you can really see the beginnings of the Tea Party in some respects. I mean, I don't know if there was another film that captured that movement conservativeness more than your film. So highly recommended.
Thank you. It's available on Netflix, et cetera. So we actually just had a screening recently, and it's shockingly current, I'm sorry to say, even though it was filmed in 1994.
Yeah, it is. It's rather disturbing. You could see it there. It was very prophetic in many ways, I guess, or at least should have been a warning to some people. But let's talk about Advise and Dissent. Particularly interesting, obviously, with the nature of the ruling that we got on the Affordable Care Act. But let's basically just talk a little bit about what the film follows. It essentially follows two activists who are agitating for and against the Bush's Supreme Court picks. I'm talking about Manuel Miranda of the Third Branch Conference and Ralph Nees, who was then the president of People for the American Way. And you get a lot of behind-the-scenes footage of how those two entities are working, and also the two sort of main players on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Leahy and Specter. But talk a little bit about I was really interested in Manuel Miranda, how much influence this guy had. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Manny was somebody who I identified quite early on in the process, and it was just kind of a lucky bet. He, as you see in the film, is basically running this conference call out of his living room. And the reason that he's doing that is because he had previously worked on the Hill. He worked for Hatch. He worked for Frist. But he had been drummed off the Hill when it was discovered that he was actually reading and leaking files from the Democratic side of the Judiciary Committee. And that was just one step too much for them, so they kicked him out. But it actually set him up to be in a surprisingly powerful position of the conservative who had nothing to lose and hadn't, and was perfectly happy to speak his mind when others wouldn't. And so it turns out that he played a pivotal role in that whole drama of Bush's nominees, which many people may have forgotten, included the nomination of Harriet Myers, who was then really rejected by conservative forces led by Manny Miranda. And that's what gave us Samuel Alito.
Yeah, I mean, that was the sort of the most amazing aspect of this film, was to see the sort of theoretically the institutional power behind the People for the American Way. It you know, we're talking 20 a staff of, I don't know, 20, 25 people, maybe more. I'm just saying that we're
more. Yes, at that point, many more.
And sitting in conference rooms, strategizing. And then this Manny Miranda, who was literally cramped behind his couch on a tiny desk and a computer, and was able to just drum up all of this intense opposition to Harriet Myers. And one moment really struck me when he talked about, and this goes to the heart, I think, of in some respects, to the problems that liberal advocacy groups have in advocating across a broad spectrum. He was saying at that time, like, I'm not afraid of the evangelicals. This is Manny Miranda. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid. He had basically was saying, like, there's no one who is too crazy or too toxic in the conservative movement that I am afraid of associating with and not bringing along in this fight. Talk to me about that dichotomy between, his sort of not worrying about who was in his coalition versus what we see often on the left.
You've absolutely put your finger on it, Sam. I mean, I think, you know, at Manny, it turns out on his shelf had a book about how the Bork fight was won, and he had learned from them. And I think that we need to turn around and learn from him, because it really is the obsession with message control and discipline and loyalty that so many people have on our side and you know across the board can handicap you when you have a cause that you really want to advocate for, and Manny's power precisely lay in that in his fearlessness.
Yeah, I mean that's what was so stunning about it. I mean, to me, was that it was a perfect sort of example. I mean, across the board of the temerity of liberal advocacy groups, and almost how, you know, when you have an operation of that size that is so dependent on funding from many sources, obviously. I mean, someone's got to pay the bills for the People for the American Way. And every time you sort of, we didn't see any explicit rejection of support from different sectors. But anytime you are that dependent on that type of funding, it makes it basically creates these other constraints. In the Bork fight, which many people sort of, at least on the right, peg all of their sort of modern, advocacy regarding the court. Was there much more abandon? Was there much more sort of an organic protest against Bork? How did that shake out?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I want to say, as much as we may feel from the film that People for the American Way, has to answer to a lot of masters, and I don't think that's entirely wrong. On the other hand, I want to give them a definite shout out. They, in fact, were the only organization on the left that was willing to open their doors to me. So there's a whole array of other organizations in this coalition that didn't have that kind of transparency or courage. So, that in a way, that's the tip of the iceberg, both in terms of what they have to answer to and in terms of their courage. I do think that I have some knowledge of the Bork matter, and certainly at that time, some of those organizations were smaller. And people on the left do put a lot of stake in coalitions and coalition building, and that is not entirely a bad thing at all. So we need to recognize that. But they were also out in uncharted territory, and I think they were willing to take risks that maybe they weren't so willing to take, the left as a whole wasn't willing to take years later. And I know that, there were issues about not just their funders, but also the relationship between the advocacy groups and the elected officials. I mean, at some point, Manny Miranda on the right turns around and says, essentially to the White House, look, I know this is your person, but top, the president is going to lose all of us on the right, if he doesn't pull Harriet Myers. And that's what happened. On the left, it was a much more complicated situation. And as Ralph says in the film, you can't, unless you have leaders in the Senate, you're not going to make that happen. And nobody really stepped up to that. I'm on the mailing list of Russ Feingold's new progressive organization, Progressives United or whatever it's called. And every time I get an email from them about the court, I think, well, I'm really glad they're on that issue, but Russ Feingold voted for John Roberts when he was on the Judiciary Committee. And he had a great deal of power and authority at that point and could have made a difference by not voting for him, as did Pat Leahy of Vermont. So, you know, it's obviously you're in a different position when you're on the inside, but, you know, we need the insiders as well as the outsiders.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a great example because, I mean, first off, I remember when this fight was happening. I remember that People for the American Way seemed to be the only organization that was getting out in front, particularly on Roberts. And then things happened so quickly that it was that much harder to get out in front of Alito. And Feingold, I remember the frustration at the time because Feingold was very much an institutionalist in many respects and felt that there was a foregone benefit of the doubt that went to the president. Okay. And what we've seen, and I think, you know, it comes into stark relief, and it was your film was predictive of what we would see going forward, was that there was a very deliberate political strategy in picking a nominee with no paper trail to begin this sort of process of vanilla-izing the nominees. And Harriet Myers, in some respects, was an extension of that. It fell through and allowed Bush to nominate Alito. But at one point, I mean, I guess it seems that the Republicans just seem to understand the political nature of the Supreme Court in a way that Democrats seem to hold on to this notion of protecting the institution. Now, the reasons why that happens may have to do more with, you know, how much the Democrats are institutional and establishment oriented in and of themselves. But give me your take on that.
Well, I don't know. I want to back up, Sam, and say, you know, if you read the New York Times in the last few days, you'll come to the conclusion that Roberts has no political agenda and that he's now proven that he is just an umpire who's calling balls and strikes. Don't you think so?
Well, I know that Thomas Friedman now, I think, is ready to give John Roberts the Medal of Freedom and is now hanging every cut in on Social Security on the back of John Roberts' valor that we should all take. I mean, but that is the point. I mean, people still, in some respects, don't see the sort of the political nature of what Roberts did. And that's coming even now that we see that at least there's reports that what he was doing was his decision was very much based on politics within the court and outside the court.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I was being.
Oh, no. I know. Yes. I was being doubly facetious.
I think that, you know, Roberts is and always has been a political animal. And my feeling is that what really has happened since Bork in terms of how we choose Supreme Court justices, and the Senate has a big role in that because they need to confirm a nominee for him to become a justice, him or her to become a justice. But what's really happened is that we've allowed the right to cow us into not talking about politics and not talking about judicial ideology. Sotomayor got up there and basically, actually, I think literally quoted the balls and strikes umpire metaphor that Roberts did, and Kagan did the same thing. And what that does is it deprives the American people and their elected representatives of an opportunity, the one opportunity that was designed by the founders, to have a say in what kind of court, what kind of justice, what kind of justices we're going to have. And that's what the advise and dissent provision is supposed to, advise and consent provision is supposed to be about in the Constitution, is giving the elected representatives of the people a chance to say, hey, this is what we want going forward in the court. You know, this is what the will of the nation is. Because after that, of course, you know, lifelong tenure means that the judges can do whatever they want. So you've got the judicial independence. What you need is a chance for the democratically elected representatives to have their say. And by letting a Roberts get away with saying, I have no ideology, or a Sotomayor, or a Kagan, or an Alito even, to claim that they have no ideology and that they're just going to decide things fairly, we don't have that discussion.
And it also seems to me that what it does is it narrows the playing field as to who can be appointed a Supreme Court justice. I mean, there was a time where the idea of having a non-judge become a Supreme Court justice, or even for that matter, I guess maybe a non-attorney, or at least a non-practicing attorney sit on the Supreme Court was not so unimaginable. And
Earl Warren was the governor of California.
And so it has in many ways sort of shut down that that, I guess, pool of people, because if it's not about ideology, what's left? Well, I look great in a robe.
I went to Harvard or Yale.
I went to Harvard or Yale, and I'm very dignified. I mean, if we can't talk about a judicial philosophy in any meaningful way in terms of how it's practiced, as opposed to sort of just temperament, there's a real problem there.
Yes, I agree, and we need to remember that. And I think that as we go forward, we can't fall for the notion that Roberts is just a fair judge because of this one decision. You know, I think if you look at the overall drift of this court, the overall thrust of what the court has decided, even in the last 10 days, you can see that the project of those who feel that people have too many rights, that the federal government has, too much ability to secure the general welfare, is succeeding on the court, and we can't let down that our guard, let down that fight, and of course the next election is going to be crucial in that.
And do you think? I mean, I of course much has to do with the makeup of the Senate, but I mean, do you think that we're?
Yes.
I mean, it's going to be a while till we see that type of ideological fight, it seems to me, from the left anyways. I mean, I would imagine that if President Obama has the next pick, it's going to, again, I mean, I don't know. I would assume it's going to be another sort of stealth candidate, one who comes up and doesn't make an argument for a left judicial philosophy.
Well, there are, lots of people think that Obama will have his hands untied in the next term, if he gets the next term, and it could be, and I would certainly encourage that one way that his hands could be untied is that whoever he picks, the White House, whoever he nominates for the next vacancy, assuming there is one, the White House, should unleash that person. Or not just unleash that person, but should encourage that person to say something positive and substantive about the role of the court in our society, and not just talk about original intent, which is rhetoric of the right, or talk about balls and strikes, which is meaningless rhetoric. I think that there are people out there, Doug Kendall at the I'm going to forget the name of his group. Who are working on crafting a message that encapsulates the left judicial philosophy in a positive way, the way that originalism has done for the right, and I think it could be done. And if you have the Senate, you're going to get those votes anyway. You're going to so why not take that opportunity to change the conversation in the country? I do want to point out that I'm on the email list of the Kurt Levy's organization. I always forget what they're called, Committee for Justice. which is one of the leading conservative organizations, you know, advocating on the whole issue of judicial selection. He wrote his top 10 takeaways from the Obamacare decision. The second of those takeaways is five is not enough. In other words, they can't rely on Roberts anymore. Maybe they never could rely on him. So they need at least now six justices who are clearly right of center. And I think we need to know that that's the thinking that's out there. And, you know, that's what the other side is aiming for.
Why do you think it is that the left doesn't seem to be doesn't seem to have the same level of awareness of the importance of the Supreme Court? I mean, for me at this point, you know, and despite the fact that the court seems to move to the right regardless of who is replaced, it's just a question of degree. But despite that fact, for me, the Supreme Court remains the primary decision sort of factor, I guess, as I decide to who to vote in the fall. Why do you think it is that the left doesn't seem to have a broad appreciation of that?
Well, I mean, there's one good reason, which is that, you know, none of us really wants the Supreme Court to be a political football. And there is, you know, an admirable notion that the Supreme Court should be above politics and the judges should be independent. I think there's a somewhat less positive reason as well, which is that we're afraid, and you have not yet had a Democratic presidential candidate who has made the Supreme Court an issue. Really, Obama, you know, in 08, McCain had the Supreme Court and the judicial selection as one of his points on his platform and on his website. The Obama campaign did not. I suppose that they're looking at polling that tells them that it's not a winning issue, but there's polling that goes the other way too. So I think that it requires some courage from our candidates, from our leaders, and you know, it also requires us getting out there and supporting the activists who are trying to do something about it.
David Van Teller, the film is Advise and Dissent on Netflix, yes?
It is on Netflix, it's on iTunes, it's on Amazon, it's on Hulu, and you can find out more about it at our website, which is adviseanddissent.com.
It is, it's definitely worth a watch. I mean, at the very least, just to see, it's the difference between the sort of institutional and sort of almost non-institutional in the case of the right during this fight, players and how they function in this world. I appreciate you coming on, David.
Great. Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and do some stories. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. As you know, in Mississippi, the Mississippi House, essentially, had passed a bill signed by Republican Governor Phil Bryant, who has repeatedly said he wants Mississippi, the state, to be abortion-free. And the law that was passed requires anyone performing abortions at the state's one and only clinic, there is only one abortion clinic in all of Mississippi, to provide family planning services to women, B, an OBGYN with privileges to admit patients at a local hospital. Of course, these privileges are difficult to obtain, and you know, we're not talking about in the context of emergency. It is a OBGYN that has an ongoing relationship with the hospital. The problem is, of course, in Mississippi, that the one clinic that's available has two physicians who do abortions there. They are OBGYNs, but of course they travel from out of state because the environment there is so hostile to a woman's right to choose. And this law was set to go into effect. The Jackson's Women's Health Organization filed a lawsuit with the help of the Center for Reproductive Rights, which is based in New York. And a judge, Daniel P. Jordan, U.S. District Judge, issued a temporary restraining order on the day the new law took effect, which I believe was today or Friday. In the order, Jordan wrote, plaintiffs have offered evidence, including quotes from significant legislative and executive officers, that the act's purpose is to eliminate abortions in Mississippi. They likewise submitted evidence that no safety or health concerns motivated its passage. And the evidence has yet to be rebutted. In other words, you can't pass a law with the purpose of denying women a right that has been extended to them by the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court. Now, of course, who knows what the court will do in the coming months or years to this right of women to have some type of autonomy over their own body. But for the time being, anyways, a U.S. district judge in Mississippi has essentially enjoined that law from taking place, and we'll see what happens in the future. Hold on for a second. Hello?
Hello.
I'm sorry? Hello?
Hello. Samuel.
Samuel,
it's Kathy.
Oh my gosh. It's
Senator Kathy.
Well, not so much Senator, but nearly Senator Catherine Harris. Not really even nearly.
Hello, Samuel.
It's been so long, I barely recognized your voice.
Yes, it has been a long time. So much has happened. I'm in your city. You're in New York City, the Big Apricot.
The Big Apricot?
Yes, isn't that what they call it?
Apple. I think it's the Big Apple.
Big Apricot.
About.
Yes, I just got here. Marcus has been here, though. He insisted on being here by June 24th for some reason. He said,
wait, Marcus Bachman?
There was some parade. My BFF. She wanted to be here for some parade or other. But anyway.
June 24th, wasn't that the Pride?
Was it austerity celebrations or something?
I don't think so, but so you're in the city with your BFF Marcus.
Marcus, he also wanted to see a live taping of WTF with Mark Maron. Have you ever heard of that?
I have actually.
Mark Maron, WTF.
Yeah.
I hear it's all the rage.
Well, I don't.
Anyway, Sam, the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
Job killer. Sharia law were just two sects. We also look what's happened already. Poor Jamie Dimon lost so much, $9 billion already. Thanks, Obama.
Wait a second. Are you saying that that Chase lost $9 billion?
JP Morgan.
Yes, JP Morgan lost $9 billion
because of the activist judges. Listen, Sharia law is right around the corner, which is, it's like ringing the dinner bell for all the secret Muslims. Listen, so that's why I'm in New York, and I met up with Marcus. And listen to me, we have been meeting with the Gatestone Institute. You know that think tank?
No.
They are all about stopping Sharia law and activist judges.
Wait a second. I'm sorry. You're going to have to explain this to me. How does the Affordable Care Act impose Sharia law and then cause J.P. Morgan Chase to lose $9 billion?
Because it's about government. You know, this started way back with that Ralph Nader and the seatbelts. Unbelievable. The activist Ralph Nader and the seatbelt. All he's doing is putting the federal government between you and your windshield.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing.
You're breaking up, Sam. I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, listen to me. So we're meeting with Nina Rosenwald. Do you know her? Heiress to the Sears Roebuck fortune.
I know.
And she spends millions of dollars through the William Rosenwald Family Fund to stop the invading menace of Sharia law and activist judge. You should know her. Her father founded the Jewish Appeal, the United Jewish Appeal, Samuel.
I had no idea.
She sits on the board of AIPAC.
No, I'm
not. She knows we must strike the Islamic Republic of Iran. Sam Brownback knows this. Michelle Mabel Bachman knows this. Sam, listen, I'd like to quote Theodore Herzl, if I may.
Sure. I had no idea.
The Zionist forefather. I don't know why I have to educate you. You better get down to a yeshiva. You're a terrible Jew.
I appreciate that. That's very sweet of you. Well, go ahead and...
Theodore Herzl, now paraphrasing here. Assimilation of the Jews in Europe is impossible. Now, he was talking about the Dreyfus Affair, but we can apply that today. The Jewish state must have an entrance strategy for Jesus. Praise him, Breitbart, white power.
Wait a second. The Jewish state must have an entrance strategy for Jesus?
Yes, praise him, Breitbart, white power. Listen, also, you know how much I love Moshe Dayan.
I do, yes.
You know, he won the Oscar for The King and I. But we are having free screenings of Westworld. He was wonderful in that with Richard Benjamin. Westworld, do you remember that?
Yeah, I'm almost sure that you're thinking of Yul Brynner.
Westworld. So we're showing it because it's a wonderful metaphor for the threat of the barbarians. In that case, it was robots, but in this case, it's secret Muslims and Islamists and activist judges and the threat on Western civilization.
Well, let me get more...
Michael Crichton knew this. Moshe Dayan knew this.
Wait a second. Let me just stop you and ask you specifically, what did you think about John Roberts' ruling? Were you surprised by that?
I'm very surprised. You know, he has always had a long history of business-friendly jurisprudence. So I don't know, maybe it was something he ate or I don't know. But, you know, he quite rightly understands what the founders wanted. They wanted the corporation as a person to be thought of first, boardroom first. That's the John Roberts Court. I know and love business-friendly jurisprudence. It's the bedrock of our electoral process. From 1886, the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad to today.
I had no idea the depth of your awareness of these court rulings. I
had no idea about the lack of depth of yours. You're a terrible Jew.
What has that got to do with my Jewishness?
What has it not got to do with it? You know we need an entrance strategy. You know, I still get so angry I could spit when I think about how they treated poor Moshe Dayan. And in 1973, he was blamed for being unprepared in the October War. Makes me so mad. And he resigned, but then, you know, he wouldn't have shot Westworld. So it worked out.
I'm almost convinced it's Yul Brynner you're thinking of, but that's neither here nor there.
Who?
Yul Brynner.
I don't know who that is, but I love Moshe Dayan. He's wonderful. The Six-Day War. Oh my goodness! You know he even fought in World War II.
Yeah.
For the British, who are sort of like us, like Canadians, they're similar to us. In their whiteness and their Anglo-Saxonness, Breitbart, praise him, white power.
Catherine Harris.
You know what else is going on, Sam? I don't want to let you talk. Listen to me. There's also, we're going to go to Kentucky after this for the celebrations at the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky. Wait,
I wasn't aware that there were celebrations at the Creationist Museum.
It's the 5th anniversary of the Creation Museum in Petersburg.
I didn't know.
They're going to have, you know what they've installed? A holographic exhibit of Lucy, the famous proto-human fossil. And they're going to show how, they're going to prove how she's just really a few thousand-year-old ape. Joseph the plumber's going to be there.
Joseph the plumber's going to be there? And part of it is, I guess, his campaign.
You're breaking up again.
I can hear you fine.
They're also going to have a Clarence Darrow, throw a beanbag at Clarence Darrow at the museum. Because he was so mean to Williams Jennings Bryan. He was a fool. Also, there's a Mitch McConnell look-alike contest, and you can whack him in the face with a board for $1. We're going to raise money for the group Answers in Genesis. They run the Creation.
No, I'm fully aware of Answers in Genesis.
They're going to build a full-size replica of Noah's Ark. We got to raise money for the new Ark Encounter.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was what's going on in Florida. Rick Scott seems to be hell-bent.
He's talking to kings and queens.
I think you're thinking of
Scott Walker.
Brown.
I'm sorry. I just heard Scott. You're breaking up. You said Rick Scott.
Rick Scott, yes, the governor in Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, you were, of course,
praised the, by power.
The Secretary of State in Florida during the 2000 election. It has really been your claim to fame. You brought us George Bush in many respects.
Yes, I have helped carry out the Father God's will, Breitbart.
And Rick Scott has been desperately trying to throw about 180,000 people off the voter rolls. And
absolutely. It's called voter fraud, Sam. It's called voter fraud.
Well, I mean, it's already been shown that nearly half, at least, of those people on those rolls are eligible to vote, and you've got 67 heads of counties there who are refusing to follow the orders of Rick Scott. I mean, I'm curious.
Activism, that's the thing. Look, it's all falling apart. Poor Jamie Dimon. Listen, poor Rupert Murdoch. You see what happened because of that Affordable Care Act, Rupert Murdoch.
But how did the Affordable Care Act hurt Rupert Murdoch?
Rupert Murdoch has just been, he got in trouble in Britain.
No, I'm aware of that story.
Prime Minister David Cameron turned his back on him.
But how does that happen?
Thanks to activist Judge Brian Levison, he said that Rupert Murdoch was up to no good. Listen, I'll tell you something. Wendy Dang is angry, and she will cut you. We've talked about this before. She's got Japanese steel. She has a Hari Hanzo sword. Wendy Dang in the Crazy 88. You know, she used to be in the Deadly Viper Squad, Sam, codenamed Cottonmouth.
I was not aware of any of this.
She will cut you, Wendy Dang.
Now, wait a second. Now, so you're saying the Levinson inquiry is, you're saying that's a function of activist judges, but I don't understand how that has to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Because this is what activist judges, this is what happens, Sam, that we have to sit at the table with black people. We have to wear seat belts. We have to pick up after ourselves with the environment. Well, sort of, don't have to really. But this is the kind of nonsense that made a hero out of Rosa Parks. This is not what the fuck. You know what God's plan is, Sam?
No.
As it ever was to elevate the rich and well-born to legislative influence.
God's plan.
What do you think the three-fifths clause was all about?
Wait a second. You're saying
the slave owner, wealthy, one man and extra one vote.
You're saying that the God's plan is to basically
elevate the rich and the well-born to legislative influence. Samuel, come on now. What do you think Joseph is shooting produce all about? It's a fulfillment of God's will. Praise him, Breitbart, ISA, white power.
Now, wait a second. You're saying that did you say ISA?
What?
You're saying that Joe the plumber shot vegetables?
Produce. To show you what happens when we defy the founders who were imbued by the Father God. Don't you remember? You're from Massachusetts, right? Isn't that where? Is that where Daniel Shays, activist farmer, Shays?
Actually, Shays Rebellion happened in Worcester.
Currency.
That's right. Actually, he marched on Worcester.
Worcester.
Yeah, it was Worcester.
Yeah, that's where you're from, Worcester. Don't think I don't know that.
Well,
I don't know about what goes on in Worcester. Started with activist farmer Daniel Shays, and then now you keep. I get so mad, Sam. I'm still so angry about Moesha Dayan.
What are you mad about?
That's free screening for Westworld.
All right, wait a second. Let me get your take. I don't think I've talked to you since the primary had been mostly decided. Mitt Romney is the Republican nominee. Your thoughts?
Well, Mitt Romney, you know, as a Mormon, I think what's great about him is many, many Mormons also believe that the earth is only a few thousand years old. So that's the good news. Also, Mitt Romney declared that Park 51 in New York City, your city, the building of Park 51, remember the Interfaith Community Center and mosque that was planned to be built a few blocks from Ground Zero, it's a blasphemy. Mitt Romney declared that Park 51 has the potential for extremists to use the mosque for global recruiting and propaganda. Mitt Romney's right on time with that one.
Why haven't they continued to protest that?
Don't worry, Marcus is down there all the time. He's there with Michelle Mappel's going to join him. But as I said, Marcus insisted on being here for some reason on the 24th. I think he also, besides wanting to see Mark Maron, have you heard of Mark Maron's podcast?
I have. Yeah. Yeah.
I hear it's wonderful.
Well, I haven't heard it.
I hear it's wonderful. He also wanted to see a live taping of What Not to Wear.
Of What Not to Wear?
Yeah, it's a show he likes. It's about makeovers and so forth. He's wonderful.
Yes. Well, Senator Harris, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your calling in and sharing with us today your thoughts on this Affordable Care Act. And, you know, of course, Rick Scott.
It's a job killer. It's a Ponzi scheme, like the low flow toilet and the seat belt. It's just a job killer.
How is the low flow toilet a job killer?
We've talked about this before, Sam. I don't want to get into it again. Don't make me quote Theodore Herzl, Zionist forefather, again. Don't make me school you in what you're already supposed to know. You're a terrible Jew. It's a job killer. You're a job killer.
Wait a second. The low-flow toilet? Herzl spoke about low-flow toilets?
The pigtail light bulb, the seatbelt, all job killers. Thanks, Obama.
Well, all
thanks
right.
A lot, Obama.
Well, there you have it, Senator Kathy Harris. I appreciate your calling in. You should
don't forget free screenings of Westworld, and then also don't forget the Kentucky Museum creation. We're raising money for the Noah's Ark encounter, and if you go down there, you can punch Mitch McConnell lookalikes in the face for a dollar to raise money.
Well, thank you. Please don't be so much of a stranger. We missed you around.
Oh, no, I would love to. You know, anytime I can come, you know, talk to you on the phone, it's always a pleasure for me because you don't seem to know anything about anything. You always seem stunned. You always seem like it's the first time every time we talk.
It's well, some of the things that you say, I guess maybe it's the way you say them that sort of surprise me.
No, don't do that. Don't rubber your gloomy, Samuel. That's the height of immaturity. That's what an unclever, non-well yeshiva Jew does. That's what a non-yeshiva Jew does. I get Nina Rosenwald down there. She'll tell you what for.
Okay, well, I don't want to end this on a bad note. I want to be cordial about this.
No. Oh my God, I just swallowed saliva down the wrong pipe. Have you ever done that?
I have, of course, sure.
Oh my God, that's so funny when that happens. Oh, also, Samuel, you went to law school for about a minute and a half, right?
That's right.
Till the meter ran out, and then you had to move your car. You decided just not to go to law school anymore. Richard Thompson, former Michigan prosecutor, he's the president of the Thomas More Law Center.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are confronting the threat of Islam and Sharia law. They're working with Sam Brownback and Michelle Mabel and Herman Cain, Daryl Issa, Joseph the Plumber, all these people, Nina Rosenwald.
Well, you got to keep us updated on the Sharia law thing, because I
knee quab. You got to be wearing it. Your wife would be wearing a knee quab before you know what happened.
I'm sorry, I should be wearing what?
A knee quab. The thing that covers your face, except your eyes. You'd probably like that, wouldn't you? You'd probably see your wife as chattel.
No.
White power. Breitbart, Issa.
Okay. Well, Sarah Catherine Harris, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Don't forget, try that Marc Maron. I hear you.
Yeah,
wonderful.
No, I will. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's great. All right, bye. Well, it seems Senator Catherine Harris, huge fan of WTF. That's great to hear. Folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. You can support this show so that you can hear it on a daily basis by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is your support exclusively that keeps this show alive. Whether you want the added material as we head into the better half of the program and I discuss Rick Scott's announcement that he will not be taking the expansion of Medicare for Florida, the implications of that, the story of the ExxonMobil CEO who feels we should just get over global warming. Whether it's any of these stories, whether I talk about how apparently I am the worst parent on Twitter in the world, according to some journalists and self-styled moralists on Twitter, who apparently lack a sense of humor. All of that and more in the better half of the program, but that's not the main reason to become a member. The main reason to become a member is simply so that you can continue to listen to the program that you listen to 2, 3, 4, 5 days a week. 1 day a week. Tomorrow on the program, Bill Scherer will be defending his op-ed in extolling the virtues of President Obama. May have somebody else on to follow up, Bill, who will be less than extolling of President Obama's virtues. You can also support this show by buying justcoffee.coop, fair trade, organic, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy junk through Amazon, go to majority.fm/support the show. Click on our support the show link. Click on the Amazon button. Bookmark that. Buy all your Amazon junk through there. We get a kickback. You can buy merch. You can give us a review on iTunes. If you listen on Stitcher, you can announce that you're listening on Stitcher with, I think, one touch button. You can tell your friends about the program. You can tell other podcasts that you listen to have me on as a guest, I guess. Someone told me that I should be doing that. All right, folks. If you want to call the program, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920.
I'm going to contact that Marc Maron guy right now and tell him that you should be on that podcast he does.
Yeah, apparently that would be helpful. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be right back.